This open source conversation about nuclear weapons and the Cold War was first recorded in 2006.
From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The 40-year nuclear standoff known as the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union broke one of the oldest rules of human behavior, that when weapons are developed, they will be used. Historian John Lewis Gaddis wonders if the Cold War could mark an evolutionary shift for all time in the understanding that nuclear war between states is poison for both adversaries and the planet, and therefore an anachronism, which makes you wonder why embattled states today like India and Pakistan, Israel and Iran rate nuclear war capacity so highly. If they asked the men who owned nukes in abundance through the Cold War, from Stalin to Ronald Reagan, they'd find tough guys who feared and hated nuclear war more, perhaps, than the rest of us. In Gaddis's hindsight and Richard Reeves's reconstruction, it's above all the romantic old B-actor Reagan who imagined the world out of nuclear madness. Cold War lessons are next on Open Source. First, the news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the radio voice of a web community that's interested in just about everything, as you can see at www.radioopensource.org. This hour, the 40-year Cold War that we all survived without a shot being fired, between the principals, that is, and Cold Wars yet to come, it seems, in the Middle East and elsewhere. Where is the lesson book, and who's to tell the wannabe nuclear players of a new century what the old Cold War practitioners all learned along the way, that those damn nukes were for so many reasons unusable? John Lewis Gaddis, the historian at Yale, fired up this conversation with a slim and stylish summing up of the Cold War, A New History, which President Bush is said to have read and recommended. Richard Reeves adds his own reassessment that heaps up still more praise on that elusive dreamer who brought the Cold War curtain down, Ronald Reagan. The way into this conversation is through the website at radioopensource.org. Happy President's Day, Professor Gaddis. I hope you'll start in the present and work back. What is it that the chiefs in Pakistan and India and North Korea and Iran and Israel, for that matter, haven't learned about these miserably useless weapons? What haven't they learned about the Cold War?
Well, I think it's a little early to say what they've learned and what they haven't learned, and I'm not sure that I would buy the argument that they are totally useless weapons. I think they are totally useless on the battlefield, but it seems to me the role they played in the Cold War itself was pretty useful in terms of persuading statesmen at the top to think twice before they let small quarrels escalate into large wars. We had plenty of historical examples before nuclear weapons were developed of how easily that could happen, and it did not happen in the nuclear age, and I think those weapons were useful in that regard.
Could they be useful yet in the future as stabilizers, as sort of doomsday weapons that somehow pacify the players?
Well, some of my political science international relations theory friends have actually argued yes, and that for that reason we should welcome the proliferation of nuclear weapons. I'm a little more skeptical and nervous about that proposition, because the one thing that one can say of the Cold Warriors was that they were all, in their own way, rational actors. They did not have death wishes, and I'm not as firmly convinced about some of the actors that might be getting nuclear weapons in the current situation.
Well, we weren't so sure at the time. I mean, Richard Nixon thought it was a good thing to be thought of as a madman. He might do anything.
Well, he liked to convey that impression, yes. But that was, I think, for the purpose of trying to keep the adversary off balance. And there were a fair number of other Cold War statesmen who had similar ideas. Whether I'd be interested in Richard Reeves' take on this, but whether Reagan intended it or not, I think it's very clear that the Russians at one point regarded him as something of a madman.
Absolutely. We don't know who the nutcakes are until it's all over. But go back a moment. There have been people, including Henry Kissinger and others, who said these things might be necessary or useful even in firing them. My question, I guess, about the present players in the light of the Cold War history, our Cold War history, is, does it come with the job? Does it come with having them that you realize suddenly these things are completely beyond the pale? Beyond barbarity, as Stalin said.
I think for the most part, historically, that has been the pattern, that the people who have developed, the states that have developed nuclear weapons, have found it extremely difficult to think of circumstances in which they might actually be used. But would that pattern hold for the future? Historians are going to be very skeptical about trying to predict the future.
Would it even hold in the past? I mean, would Hitler have used nuclear weapons if he had them?
That's a really good question. Of course, we don't have any way to know the answer to it.
Would Stalin?
Well, Stalin had them and didn't. And would he have used them if he had got them first? We can't really be sure of that. What we do know is that the nation that did get them first had occasion to use them, and indeed was suffering a severe military defeat in the Korean War at a time when we still had an effective monopoly over atomic weapons. The Russians had it, but didn't have as many as we did. And President Truman set a precedent for not using them in that situation. He could easily have done that, and I even have included a couple of counterfactual paragraphs in that book.
Scared me. I thought, wait a second, did I miss something? Yeah, me too.
To show how easily that could have happened.
This is John Lewis Gaddis playing Kurt Vonnegut, but you're waltzing through the history of the Korean War when suddenly we lob one at the Chinese or they lob one at us, and suddenly Europe is going up in smoke. And I thought, wait a sec, I was alive. What did I miss? And you finally pulled us out. I wish you'd just take us quickly through, in effect, the main thesis of this book, is that after 40 incredibly scary years, there was an evolutionary shift here.
Well, I think the main thesis of the book is that while the Cold War for more than 40 years seemed like an extremely dangerous period, and there were all kinds of horrors that were associated with the Cold War, nuclear weapons were only one, that looking back on it now, from the standpoint of some 15 years after the Cold War ended, I think it's going to be regarded as a hopeful period for humankind, in the sense that the great Third World War that everybody feared never developed, the nuclear weapons that everybody was afraid of did not get used, more than that, the world came out of this conflict with authoritarianism discredited, with democracy reinforced, with capitalism certainly the dominant ideology. So looking back on it, and particularly comparing the last half of the 20th century with the first half of the 20th century, we didn't do all that badly in the Cold War.
Well, as you say, we survived it. That's the best thing you could possibly say about any war. But you're not going to say that it didn't scare you, or even looking back, that there weren't extraordinarily dangerous moments, and not just the Cuban Missile Crisis either. For me, the moment when the Soviets in Afghanistan seemed tempted to proceed through the Khyber Pass and might, in some view, have threatened our control of the Persian Gulf, and people like Henry Kissinger and James Schlesinger and others were saying, you know, we might just have to use the nukes on this one.
I don't regard that one as having been particularly serious. I think the person who got most alarmed about that was Brzezinski, and I think who was Carter's national security advisor, and I think he was overreacting to that situation. It seems to me the most dangerous moment, apart from the missile crisis, is the Able Archer crisis of late 1983 in the Reagan period, when the Russians interpret a NATO military exercise as preparation for a first strike. And that was scary indeed, and it was all the more scary for the fact that outside of a few people who were cleared to know about it, hardly anybody on the outside knew that that was happening.
This gets us into the Ronald Reagan area, which is also Richard Reeves's, especially with a, to me, hugely wonderful reconstruction of the mind and the presence and the presidency of Ronald Reagan. But I'd love to hold that actually until after the break. I'd love you to take us through your heroes of this period, John Gaddis, and most particularly, you know, the mark of the men that kind of kept us alive and kept their own sanity. And the woman, perhaps, Margaret Thatcher, too.
Yeah. Well, you know, to go back to an early point, I would certainly put Truman himself there for the responsibility and the caution that he showed as the only person who had ever authorized the use of a nuclear weapon, and yet his willingness to set the precedent that these things would not automatically be used when we got into future conflicts. That was enormously important, mm-hmm. It seems to me. Eisenhower's own sense of the extreme devastation that could result if they were used on a massive scale, the idea of a nuclear winter, which became prominent in the public discourse in the 1980s, was actually there in Eisenhower's mind at the time that he was president. So it seems to me that he's very important in this as well.
I'm impressed in your book to the degree to which Eisenhower absolutely refused to think of tactical or partial or halfway uses.
And I think he was dead right about that, because he understood, as somebody who had been in war himself, that once a war gets started, emotion takes over and rationality goes out the window. And the people who were talking about limited use of nuclear weapons were presuming that rationality would survive into and through the uses of nuclear weapons. And in retrospect, that seems implausible.
And then Nixon, Johnson, up to the moderns, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Well, I tend to have very little that's positive to say in the book about Lyndon and Johnson, because it seems to me that the single biggest mistake that the United States made in the Cold War was the Vietnam War and the misjudgment of our national interests in that particular situation, and the extent to which we escalated at a far faster rate and with many more troops than we have seen anything like in the Iraqi situation, and then did not know how to get out of it, or at least Johnson did not know how to get out of it. That was left to Nixon and to Kissinger to extricate us from that conflict, but it was a huge, costly, tragic, and I think unnecessary distraction from where the real concerns were, which were the Soviet Union, China, the important things that were going on elsewhere in the world.
Which gets you to Ford, Carter, Reagan, and the end. You're part of a rather broad movement now to rehabilitate this rather mysteriously wonderful Ronald Reagan.
Well, I've always been sort of a Reagan revisionist. I had some sense, even while he was president, that there was more going on than met the eye. And certainly from the time that he left office, I've been trying to persuade my academic colleagues to take him more seriously. That's become easier to do as we've begun to get the documents.
It's a fascinating tack, and we're going to come back right at it with Richard Reeves, whose new book is called Ronald Reagan, The Triumph of Imagination. Hindsight on the Cold War this hour with John Lewis Gaddis and Richard Reeves. This is Open Source. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Brendan. I am the Open Source blogger-in-chief. Last week, Henry talked to a member of the crew to View. It's a parade that was tongue-in-cheek before the storm. This year, they have elected as their Grand Marshal ex-FEMA chief Michael Brown. Also, several of you asked that we talk to John Perkins about his history as an economic hitman. We're doing it tomorrow. The discussion is already moving at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Hindsight on the Cold War, this hour, 2020, and it's not what you thought. John Lewis Gaddis is the historian at Yale, whose new book is called The Cold War, A New History. Richard Reeves, who I think is my favorite political writer of them all, has a new book out called Ronald Reagan, The Triumph of Imagination. It was the imagination, Richard, that everybody thought was so foolish about Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
That was the joke. The fantasist didn't know the movie from the history.
Right. Well, the still doesn't. I mean, to a certain extent, Reagan, who I came to admire in doing this, my politics are different, but Ronald Reagan turned out to be an effective president, despite what we thought.
And a kind of deep down, ardent, risk-taking peacenik.
Well, you could say that. I mean, you've got to go back to the end of his 6 years as presidency. He was on his ass because of Iran-Contra and other things, and he was almost totally abandoned, not only by the liberals and the press, but by his own people, including columnists like George Will. And then he went out on his own, as Gorbachev was going out on his own, and they cut this deal, which cut the Cold War short a lot quicker than it would have otherwise. Reagan's great strength was that he understood that communism was going to fall of its own weight. And that gave him a great advantage. And then in those last 2 years, he finds a Soviet leader who agrees with that. And the two of them then change history.
My sense, I want Professor Gaddis's view on this, but that the anti-nuclear revulsion in Ronald Reagan went very deep and it went way back. You spoke of Brzezinski under Carter panicking about the Khyber Pass and the Russians coming at the Gulf. That was 79 or 80, and I remember very well, and I was covering that stuff at the time, Ronald Reagan said, well, we might just have to quarantine Cuba, and thank God that there's more oil under Alaska than there is under all of the Persian Gulf.
Right.
Talk about fact and fantasy. But the last thing he would have done would have brought nuclear weapons to the table.
Well, I think that's right, and I think the other thing that's really fascinating about Reagan in the late 70s is that he did not panic about the Russians. That was the period of the Committee on the Present Danger, a bunch of very well-informed people, supposedly, who were saying that the Russians were zooming ahead in military capabilities of the United States at that point. They were dead wrong, as history proved, and even though Reagan was a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, he never bought this Russians are 12 feet tall argument. He said from the mid-1970s, and probably Richard would know even earlier, that this was a country and a system that could not hang together.
It was his great strength, knowing that with the certainty of an old man. And I go back when I talk about when Gorbachev visited the U.S. in December of 87. December 8th, 1987 was the day he greeted the crowds in Connecticut Avenue, hopped out of the limousine. But there was a state dinner that night, and that was the dinner where Van Cliburn played Moscow Nights, and the Gorbachevs jumped up. Then all the Russians jumped up, and then the Reagans jumped up, and all the Americans jumped up and were singing away at Moscow Nights. But the two people who didn't stand up who were at table were George Will and Richard Perle. And 2 days later, George Will wrote that December 8th, 1987 will be remembered longer in history than December 7th, 1941, because on December 8th, 1987, the United States lost the Cold War. Actually, it was the day we won the Cold War, really. Mm-hmm. But that's how alone Reagan was when his life and presidency climaxed with the Gorbachev meetings. I want to ask Professor Gaddis whether he would include Khrushchev and Kennedy on his list of heroes.
Well, in the sense that they managed successfully what they got themselves into, but it seems to me that at the same time, if you're talking about really dangerous Cold War leaders, Khrushchev has got to be up there pretty high. Khrushchev took risks that Stalin, for example, never took. And Khrushchev had a record of brutality in suppressing dissent in Eastern Europe that Stalin never had to do. Stalin brutal enough within his own system. So I think Khrushchev has to be held accountable for quite a bit. I mean, he created this crisis for very strange reasons. And sure, Kennedy handled it well, and Khrushchev handled it well.
When you say very, those reasons were not known to Kennedy, though.
They were not. I mean, this is what's clear in retrospect from the Soviet sources, is that Khrushchev had the weird idea that he would be able to save the Castro Revolution from what he thought was going to be another Bay of Pigs landing by putting nuclear weapons and missiles into Cuba.
I want to know from both of you how Ronald Reagan was miscast for so long in politics, and in media. I mean, to me, this recoiling from the nukes is completely in character. I suspect it went all his life. Bill Buckley says that Colin Powell says he was in that business forever, and he never met anybody who hated nuclear weapons the way Ronald Reagan did. And yet he was cast as the monster. And part of it was his own sense of humor. The bombing will begin in 6 minutes. We've just repealed the Soviet Union, and flip remarks like that. And yet...
some of his remarks went even worse. I mean, when he said that our peacekeepers in Beirut were there to train the Lebanese army, which meant they were siding with the Christians, which ended up with the truck bomb in killing 241 Marines in 1982 at the Beirut airport. So that he, like everybody, any political leader, they're a mixed bag what they actually do and they believe. But Reagan gave Cut and Run a good name, and we could learn from that today, I think.
Well, I think, you know, frankly, I think we're all three of us kind of closet Reagan fans. I have certainly of the peacenik Reagan, but I always felt that was there. He thought God put the continent here between the two oceans to create a new species called the American. We were protected. We were a continental nation. We were fundamentally safe. Stay out of people's hair. Again, if they took the Persian Gulf, you know, we've got Alaska, and we've got Cuba. We could also annex Mexico. But furthermore, I'm just wondering if Ronald Reagan was right about these things, what do we say about all the other people who we thought were moderates, but who by definition have to have been wrong?
Well, I think what you can say of Reagan is simply that he never bought into the conventional wisdom of the Cold War. And, of course, there are critics who say that he was too dumb to understand what the conventional wisdom actually was. I don't buy that. I think he was actually pretty smart.
What was it he didn't buy? He certainly thought Moscow and Karl Marx were the enemy.
What he didn't buy was he didn't buy containment and détente, which was the American policy at the time.
He didn't buy containment and détente. He did not buy mutual assured destruction, this idea of that we could be safe by holding each other hostage to nuclear attack.
I'm not sure he bought war. There's a wonderful moment in Richard Reeves' book when Reagan's original Secretary of State, General Haig, said, you know, over the cabinet table, in effect, Mr. President, anytime you want us to turn Cuba into a parking lot, just say the word and we'll get it done. And Reagan, if I'm not wrong, Richard, in your own book, said, don't leave me in a room alone with that man again. And very quickly maneuvered him out of the administration entirely. But Reagan...
That did for early retirement. I think that... Professor Gaddisman, I think there was a third great crisis. I don't know whether you would agree that where nuclear weapons might have been used, and that was if the Soviets decided to move on Berlin and then on West Germany and then on Europe, we could not have stopped them without using nuclear weapons.
Sure.
And I think an American president then, what a hell of a terrible choice, would have had to make a choice in 19... I was always a great fan of the Berlin Wall. I think it prevented a war.
Yeah.
When I mentioned Khrushchev and the hero thing, it was, in essence, both Khrushchev and Kennedy signed off on that wall. It solved both their problems.
Yeah,
Khrushchev's problem was he was losing his population. Kennedy's was he didn't want to push the button.
Right.
And with 15,000 soldiers surrounded by 500,000 Soviet soldiers... We would have had it, to keep Europe. We would have had to use nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I
don't know.
I mean, our whole strategy in NATO during this period, not just in the Berlin crises of 58 and 61, but all the way through, was to rely on the first use of nuclear weapons, and that was because of our manpower inferiority as against the Warsaw Pact forces.
Nukes are cheap, which is one of the reasons so many
Absolutely.
Of the politicians you mentioned. Love them. You don't
Very
have to spend money on troops.
Absolutely. In Richard's book, Professor Gaddis, there's the explicit reaction from James Schlesinger, Henry Kissinger, and others when Reagan, in one of his great imaginative moments up there at Reykjavik with Gorbachev, said, let's get rid of these darn things. Kissinger went bananas. He thought the man had lost his mind. We need these things. It was precisely because they're cost-effective. What do we say in hindsight about those people who wanted to tame and domesticate the dangers of nuclear war, limited nuclear war? That was Henry Kissinger's stock in trade.
Well, all kinds of people went bananas over the idea of abolishing nuclear weapons, particularly as it came up at Reykjavik. Mrs. Thatcher was not very happy with it as well, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff were not very happy with it either, which is why I think it was probably an unrealistic notion, because it was these two leaders themselves going out well beyond their own bureaucracies and their own allies. On Kissinger, though, I think you have to be very careful in treating Kissinger, because he made major advances toward lowering the nuclear danger through the negotiations on arms control, through the SALT process. That whole process now seems discredited because Reagan moved beyond it. But at the time, that was a major breakthrough, and it was a major concern for Kissinger. So to suggest that Kissinger was somehow nuke happy, I think, gets Kissinger wrong.
Well, there's an argument down the road. Brendan Greeley, our blogger-in-chief, is mining a very, very active store on the page. All of this has churned up. Brendan, what's the word?
Well, Nuther made a point yesterday talking in the thread. He asked whether this administration, the current one, has Reagan's capacity for personal diplomacy. He mentions that he's always been fascinated by the private walks that Reagan took with Gorbachev. Winston Dodson, on the same thread, points out that we may have trouble finding someone to take a walk with us. And so the question is, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, does Kim Jong-il, do they like long walks on the beach? Is that the solution?
I see very little evidence of that so far. I think that's the big difference, and it partly gets back to what I was saying earlier about the Cold War leaders had a kind of rationality that made it possible for them to meet, made it possible for them to find some common ground.
I think those two men.
So, you know, I think we have instances today where there are leaders, fortunately, of smaller and weaker states, where, at least for the moment, that's very difficult to do.
I want to ask Professor Gaddis a question myself. March 30th is the anniversary of Reagan's assassination. In my role down there, having
assassination
attempt. Sorry. In my role down there, it's at GW University where his life was saved. What would have happened if he died?
Well, I speculate. I like to speculate with my students about that, and I have just a line in the book. I don't develop the notion very thoroughly. But this would have been an administration. The Reagan administration would have lasted slightly longer than the administration of William Henry Harrison in 1841. Remember, Harrison delivered the inaugural address, caught a cold while doing it. It was the longest.
Don't remember it, but
ever, and he died within 30 days of taking office. If Reagan had been killed in that attempt, I think we would remember the Reagan administration as a historical footnote. And it seems to me that the Bush administration, meaning the George H.W. Bush administration, which would have come in at that point, would have handled things very, very differently, because it seems to me that George H.W. Bush was still very much locked into the the realist Kissingerian mindset, which would have pushed things in quite a different direction from where Reagan went, it seems to me.
Well, let's start with the fact that Henry Kissinger would have been back in the White House or the State Department or both under H.W.
Well,
I'm not so sure of that either.
Not sure of that, but I think just in terms of Bush being very much the product of the Cold War and the detente period, and being an insider, would have simply militated against dramatic departures from the conventional wisdom in the way that you got with Reagan.
My own feeling is that
Richard Reeves.
I had to think about it because of this. The Cold War would not have been, I mean, what Reagan did was accelerate the end of the Cold War, which I think we were going to win anyway. I mean, we had all the advantage. But if George the Elder had become president, I don't think the Cold War would have ended. It might even be going on now. I think it was the oddness of Ronald Reagan, the willingness to gamble on a one-on-one dealing with the leader of the Soviet Union. I don't think George H.W. Bush would ever... I mean, I know at the time he felt Reagan was being fooled, and that whole crowd that felt you can't trust the Russians, which probably trust but verify was Reagan's line, but I don't think it would have happened. I mean,
I would agree with that, and I would add something else, which is that you would not have had great speeches from George H.W. Bush in the way that you did with Reagan. Reagan understood the power of words, the power of rhetoric, and these magnificent speeches that were, you know, as early as 1982, saying that the Soviet Union is headed for the ash heap of history and that it's an evil empire and all of that. And then when
Mr. Gorbachev teared down that wall,
but
it's almost a main thread through Richard's book is that Ronald Reagan put words above almost everything.
Well, he thought, but on the other hand, job is not managing the government. The job is leading the people.
It's
you and I always felt, Richard, it's a magnificent model. It's something that the Democrats in the 21st century are going to have to relearn. But I want to come back to this matter of realism. The realists are said to be halfway back now after the collapse or the embarrassments of neoconservatism. On the other hand, it's the realism and the realists, including Scowcroft and H.W. Bush and Kissinger and others, who Richard's arguing would have the Cold War going to this day. I just want to throw out the fact that we never quite appreciated or knew how to defend this zone of imagination that Ronald Reagan embodied and that worked out rather providentially for the whole planet. You know, we're plunging back into realism, but what about the realm? That was a very common sense, Ronald Reagan said. First of all, it's a dull movie forever. These guys at the bar pointing guns at each other, many, many, many guns. It's a lousy movie. But secondly, we can find a way out of this thing. That's a valuable spirit. And at the time, we were told, no, you...
Well, we couldn't have gotten out of it until the old generation of Soviet leadership passed on, which
That's
they
true.
Did with great regularity. But I don't think that... I don't know if I mentioned on the air, we were talking about... Reagan was a bold fellow and a gambler. And he felt, like many great politicians, that one-on-one he could prevail over anyone.
We're talking
and
about
in fact,
a whole,
he did.
We're talking about a revaluation of Ronald Reagan in the further hindsight, both journalistic and professional historian sorts, on the Cold War. The way into the conversation is through the website, radioopensource.org. We'll be right back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the 40-year Cold War in hindsight and the danger of nuclear war yet very much a part of the world. John Lewis Gaddis, this historian at Yale, has written, I must say, an exquisitely high prose style distillation of a lifetime's study on the Cold War, A New History. And Richard Reeves has written the liveliest kind of reanimation of Ronald Reagan. But the question now is how all this applies to Iraq. Francis Fukuyama observed in the New York Times magazine yesterday that neoconservatism was in effect a child of the Cold War or is a misreading of the Cold War. It's important to know how we get there. But it's also, for me, very important to hear from you, Professor Gaddis, what George W. Bush, the incumbent, makes of all this history and how he's applying it, how we should see him in the current, what looks like an awful quagmire to me in Iraq. Something I would argue that Ronald Reagan wouldn't have done in a billion years. But make the connection with post-Cold War thinking, George W. Bush in Iraq.
Well, it's hard to know what Reagan would have done in this particular situation, but one thing that George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan have in common, along with Jimmy Carter also, is that they all believed in the progress of democracy, and they all believed that American foreign policy should be pointed toward democratizing the world. And that really is an old American tradition that goes back to Woodrow Wilson. continuity here that are worth remembering. George W. Bush did not just himself invent this idea.
I go back to Washington, though, on terms of foreign entanglements. I mean, I think that I don't think Reagan would have done this. Ronald Reagan
done the Iraq War.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan gave Cut and Run a good name. I mean, that's after he made a terrible blunder, I think, in Beirut when he during a press conference when he said the American mission was not peacekeeping, which is what it was. They're there to train the Lebanese army. The Lebanese army was a Christian army, and the Shiites then, in 1982, ended up blowing up our barracks and killing 241 of our Marines. I think that I tell a story in the book. I think Ronald Reagan was a very cautious fellow who used words to convey different impressions. But when we went into Grenada, the last meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff before the final go on that little invasion, it was a long meeting, and Reagan was distracted, maybe sleeping, but certainly wasn't paying attention, at least according to the people who were in the room. But as the meeting was breaking up, he said to John Vesey, General Vesey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, "Jack, stay a minute." And then he said, "How many men did you say you were going to land in Grenada?" And Vesey said, "Well, we think between 1,000 and 1,200. And Reagan said, "Double it." And Vesey said, "Mr. President, why should we double it? We don't need..." He said, "Because if you double the number of helicopters at Desert One, you'd be giving this briefing to Jimmy Carter, not to me." And I think that he understood, as you mentioned, Chris, somebody mentioned that words are more important. Which I think words are more important than deeds. No one remembers Lincoln's agricultural policy. And that he was terrific at talking a belligerent fight, but in fact not getting into situations that would keep us there for
I want to come back to the present day and Iraq, if I may, and to your own contention, Professor Gaddis, in a speech at Middlebury College, which I hugely enjoyed. But I kind of broke a tooth on your assertion that George W. Bush is likely to be remembered as the first great grand strategist of the 21st century. He'll be the first something of the 21st century, but where's the great grand strategy, and what's the analogy here with the oft underestimated Ronald Reagan?
Well, first of all, George W. Bush confronted a Pearl Harbor-like crisis in September 11th, and September crises like that tend to wipe the slate clean of previous assumptions, previous strategies. So I think it's quite normal that in a crisis like that, you're going to have a fundamental reconsideration of American national security priorities. That has happened. Bush has committed the country to ending tyranny throughout the world as a long-term objective. Spreading democracy in the Middle East in a way that no previous administration has committed itself to. The use of preemption where necessary, but under carefully regulated conditions. This is the trouble with grand strategies is that you don't know how they're going to come out for quite a long time. And had we been in the fifth or sixth year of the Reagan administration when we were having this conversation, Reagan would not have looked like a grand strategic genius at that point. So I think it's important precisely because of the record of Reagan and the record of certain other presidents like Eisenhower, who've been underestimated, just to suspend judgment on Bush. We don't know yet how it's going to come out. There are a lot of different ways of interpreting what's going on in Iraq. It's hard to know what the proper framework of measurement is. You can say the bottle is half empty, you can say it's half full, and make good cases both ways. But I have seen presidential reputations trivialized when the presidents were in office and then magnified after they leave office frequently enough that I would simply advise caution on Bush.
Okay, but I'd make a couple of points. First, the two men and the two dreams are somehow related. I think George Bush imagined that he could be the hero of, Arab Islam, the way Ronald Reagan is a hero in Eastern Europe. So do it, George. But he missed, I think, this is the Fukuyama argument, the neos mistakenly concluded from the Cold War that it was somehow simple or easy to turn it into a democracy. And third, the key point is Ronald Reagan didn't bomb Russia. He didn't bomb Warsaw or Petersburg. And I can't imagine that he would ever have thought he could win the Cold War, liberate Eastern Europe, by grinding the capitals of the enemy to dust in a Fallujah mode or Baghdad mode. It seems to me there's a complete break there in technique.
Or George Bush has to find his Mikhail Gorbachev. I mean, that was
fair, right? Point.
The friendship, the trust, and then the dependency between Reagan and Gorbachev. I mean, Reagan was trying to save his presidency and his ideology. Gorbachev was trying to save his ideology and his country. And you can never predict the future, but I can't see anything coming up in the next 2 years that's going to give Bush that kind of opportunity, whether or not he has the ability to seize it. I think only worse things are going to happen to him.
Well, here's the place where I would be critical of the Bush administration, and that is that I think they drew too easily on the lessons of 1989-1991 after September 11th, when they were thinking about what do we do next. And in part, they were misled by how easy Afghanistan was, which surprised everybody. Afghanistan had been the graveyard of invaders, and we went in there and prevailed at minimal cost and in a matter of months, and were welcomed. So I think that experience, together with the memory of how the Cold War ended, did prove to be deceptive for Iraq, and that's one of the reasons why the planning was so casual. It's one of the reasons why the occupation was so badly run, and so on. But is it down the tubes? Is it a failure? I'm not persuaded of that. This is a country that has, in the course of the last year, had three democratic elections, a major Arab country. It's arguably as
two more than Palestine.
It's arguably as close to having a representative government as you're going to find in any other Middle Eastern country except for Israel. So with all the problems, there have been achievements, too. And I think it simply is too early to describe it as a failure.
Come back to the matter of finding a partner. What does a historian say about just plain luck in Ronald Reagan finding Mikhail Gorbachev on his dance card, a man who made the deal? This is a marvelous paragraph in your book, Professor Gaddis. I'd like to quote just a part of it about, you know, poor Gorby. I mean, he did not have the elan of Václav Havel or John Paul. He was befuddled, almost openly so. The others, Margaret Thatcher included, had destinations in mind and maps for getting there. Gorbachev dithered. And so in the end, he had to choose between saving his empire and his ideology or giving up war, and he gave up war. You say he gave up an ideology, an empire, and his own country in preference to using force. He chose love over fear, violating Machiavelli's advice for princes, and thereby ensuring that he ceased to be one. It made little sense in traditional geopolitical terms, but it did make him the most deserving recipient ever of the Nobel Peace Prize.
Sure. So that was lucky.
Ronnie couldn't have done it without
him. That was lucky for all of us.
I'll say. Richard, you want to talk about the third world phase of the arms race and what's to be learned, what's to be applied.
Well, I think that we think that our view is on non-proliferation, et cetera. They make sense from our standpoint because we have it. But I don't think that you're going to stop anybody any place from doing it. And I think the place the first nuclear missile is most likely to be fired from, I think, is Pakistan. I lived in Pakistan and worked in Pakistan and Afghanistan as well. In fact, I lived in the same neighborhood as A.Q. Khan, the father of the Pakistani bomb, that we now know is selling it all over the world. And he would leave every day with his car between two armored cars and go out to Kohuta, where they were building the bomb. But the bomb has, I don't know how we deal with it. The bomb is the symbol of adulthood in the world today. And taking Pakistan as an example, and I think an example where you could conceive of scenarios where they'd use it, on India, that's where they're going to fire it. When I lived there, a woman who is now chairman of their national security think tank took two of my children on a drive around. This is a woman with a doctorate from Columbia, around Islamabad, and she said, there's the stadium the Chinese gave us. There's the library the Americans gave us. We don't need stadiums. We don't need libraries. We need the bum. They only respect you if you have the bum. And I think that everyone in Pakistan kind of agreed with that. And I think those are the places now that we have to watch. I agree with Professor Gaddis almost exactly on how the leaders of the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War came to know enough about each other that they could work their way out of it. That's not going to happen in other parts of the world. And if I don't know a damn thing we can do about it.
What does that mean?
They want them.
Does that mean we're doomed to repeat this 40-year scenario, this slow, very dangerous, sobering up period in area after area after area?
No, I don't think so. First of all, it seems to me there are a lot of differences between the situation we face now and the situation that we faced during the Cold War. I would agree that probably the danger of a nuclear weapon being used, whether against us or against somebody else, is actually greater now than it was in the Cold War. But the big difference is that it's only going to be one or two, and it's not going to be 5,000 or 7,000, which it could easily have been had nuclear weapons been used in the Cold War. So that's a very different situation, and I think that while nobody wants to see this happen, and while I think we have to take the nuclear threat very seriously, because even one can do horrendous damage, at the same time, it's not a Cold War scenario.
What does it take to condition the chiefs of state in, let's say, Pakistan and India to the Reagan-esque understanding of these things?
Well, one thing that could help is just a very simple question that I think everybody who develops a nuclear weapon has got to answer once they have it, and that is, what do you do with it? And there's never been a particularly good answer to that. Some people would argue, the late Mac Bundy in his book on this subject did argue, that the really interesting question is not why did so many nations develop nuclear weapons, but why did so few nations develop nuclear weapons during the Cold War? Because there were a lot more who could have done this, and they chose not to do it simply because they saw that they really are not very useful.
Well, as we've said, it's a very cost-efficient, clear, virile, crazy, what are you really feeling? Well, here's what I'm really feeling kind of statement. And yet,
but just at the same time, ask yourself, if you're a North Korean or Iranian statesman, if we can use that term.
Right.
What do you actually do with one, apart from just using it for deterrent purposes and saying you've got it and therefore you'd better not attack? I think that's how they are using it. I think that's really the purpose that these things serve. Whether they exist or whether they are threatened to exist. But when you move beyond that and say, are you actually going to use one of these things in anger against somebody else, then when you think through what the consequences of that would be, there still are considerable inhibitions.
But we'd love to think that just having one sets that kind of train of thought in motion. And that we could all come out where Ronald Reagan did after Reykjavik the first time. There's a brilliant little piece. It feels like so many things that Richard Reeves quotes in his book, written by Ronald Reagan's own hand on those 4x6 cards. But there's this fantasy. You don't. I presume you're quoting Ronald Reagan himself here, but a Reagan fantasy after Reykjavik, when he imagined that, I'm quoting now, he and Gorbachev would come to Iceland and each of them would bring the last nuclear missile from each country with them. Then they would give a tremendous party for the whole world. The president would be very old by then, and Gorbachev would not recognize him. The president would say, "Hello, Mikhail." And Gorbachev would say, "Ron, is it you?" And then they would destroy the last missile. Wonderful vision. And it's...
Amuse a man of imagination.
Bring him back. We'll listen more carefully the next time. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. Thank you, Richard Reeves. Thank you, John Lewis Gaddis. You can keep talking about the Cold War. You can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, promoting health by protecting human rights, www.phrusa.org. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, and Robin Amer, with help from Greta Pemberton, Henry Shepard, and Julia Spiro. Robin Moore was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.